From GPP News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Election integrity is questioned here in Georgia and at the highest levels of the U.S. government.
Rather than having outside professional staff or rather than having social scientists who study this information, we know that this information is going literally to the executive office of the president.
The fight over your voter information is just ahead this hour, but first we want to hear from you about love.
True love is the greatest thing in the world. Except for a nice MLT, mutton, lettuce, and tomato sandwich when the mutton is nice and lean and the tomatoes are ripe. They're so perky. I love that.
Yes, some love for the underappreciated MLT. Tell us about your love of juicy, ripe tomatoes. And this is a serious question here. What is the best way to eat a perfect vine-ripened southern tomato? Serious question. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. Will the 6th District campaign ever end? A lawsuit filed in Fulton County Superior Court seeks to overturn the June 20th results. It calls Republican Karen Handel's victory into question, alleging a data breach at Kennesaw State University's Election Center compromised the entire process. That breach exposed the records of over 6.5 million voters. The center lost its contract with the state. This week, a new proposed restraining order will bar President Trump's Voter Fraud Commission from collecting data on Georgia voters. With me now is AJC reporter Christina Torres. Christina, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, Christina. Look, I want to know if the state ever got to the bottom of the problem of what happened at Kennesaw. At Kennesaw State.
Well, I need to say that the center has not yet lost its contract. The state did say it was looking for alternatives, although right now it's status quo. They are continuing, and that's a 15-year relationship. That's not something that could unwind quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I do think state officials are concerned. We know security researchers twice, actually once before the presidential election and once after, were able to access records that should not have been accessible. And that is where the big concern was. I should add, there's no evidence that there was some sort of serious breach in that records were compromised. But I think those advocates who are questioning Georgia's system are saying you can't be sure.
But, Christina, we still haven't gotten to the bottom of it, right? How the researchers were able to access the system, that's still an open question at this point?
Well, I think I don't think it's an open question.
Okay.
I think they're pretty sure there was a misconfigured server.
Ah.
That records they thought were secure were not, and that those who know how to do this kind of thing, and I'll raise my hand and say, this is not my area of expertise, but those who are know how to do these things were able to go in and find, essentially set up their computers to do a search and find these records that should not have been accessible.
Okay, gotcha. So after the alleged breach, the group verified voting. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that group as well, because I think it's the same group involved in a couple of suits, but with the earlier suit, they were going by a different name. Verified Voting sent Secretary of State Brian Kemp a letter demanding officials use only paper ballots in the 6th district election. We want to hear from David Jefferson. He's a signee to the letter and that says Georgia's decade-old electronic voting machines are among the nation's most vulnerable to attacks.
There are far more ways than most people realize, and it's really impossible to defend against all of them proactively so that you can have confidence that there was no manipulation of the outcome of the election.
So, Christina, let's get to the nuts and bolts of this. I mean, how old are the electronic voting machines in Georgia?
So the electronic voting machines, which we all know because it's a touch screen, right? You point and get your vote picked on the screen. Georgia last updated its election systems, and it turned to those machines in 2002. So 15 years old.
15.
You know, the state comes and goes with parts. They buy parts. They, you know, reconfigure them to make sure it fits with the system. But it is an old system. And the key part of this is it does not have a paper audit trail. And cybersecurity experts especially say some of the questions that are surrounding the system right now could be eased a bit if there was some sort of paper trail, but it does not have that.
Okay, so to your knowledge, is that one of the agenda items for, I'm thinking, the next state legislative session, sort of updating where updates are needed, patching where patches are needed, updating software if that's needed?
I think it will definitely be on the agenda. In fact, Representative Scott Turner, this last session that was earlier this year, did file a bill that would encourage the state. In fact, it would require certain pieces of equipment bought after a certain time would have to have a paper audit trail. However, there's a lot of sort of bits and parts to go with this. It's a big financial undertaking to overhaul your election system.
Yeah.
And in Georgia, the mandate is it has to be uniform. And what that means is Alpharetta can't go and buy a certain election equipment that's not accessible to, say, someone in South Georgia. So that's why the state runs the election system and keeps track of the equipment to make sure it's fair, that voters in anywhere in the state have access to the same type of equipment. It's expensive. In 2002, it was at least a $54 million investment. So if you come forward to 2017, 2018, you're going to spend tens of millions of dollars to do this. However, you know, it should be said that experts recommend a newer system, something like the OptiScan units that absentee ballots are counted on. These are paper ballots that you fill in. Your choice of a candidate, they're run through a machine, but that is a paper audit trail because you have a paper
yes.
ballot to validate how you wanted to cast your vote.
So if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with AJC reporter Christina Torres. And Christina, this latest lawsuit, help me understand it here. It's claiming, am I correct here, that the Georgia system is completely vulnerable now and unreliable and should not have been used for this most recent election. And because of that, it wants Karen Handel's victory essentially tossed out?
It's questioning the security of these electronic machines. And as I said, we should add, there's no evidence that there has been some sort of breach. There's no evidence that the system has been compromised. But the lawsuit is about the possibility that you can certainly in laboratory settings go and play with the machines to make them cast a vote that was not the choice of the voter. And they say that's the concern, that because you have no audit trail where a voter can go
yeah.
back and say, yeah, that was my vote, that you're trusting the machine to be accurate. And state officials say they believe the machines are accurate. There's no evidence that they're not. But the group that's suing, and it's under the umbrella term of the Coalition for Good Governance, is saying you can't be sure.
Okay, so has John Ossoff, for example, has he challenged the results of the election? Has the DNC challenged the results of the election? How about the DCCC? Has anyone challenged, outside of this group, the results?
No, they have not. In fact, certainly Ossoff, has turned around and said he didn't have any problem with the system leading up into the election. I think obviously they were aware of some of the questions, but those sort of official groups have not challenged the result.
Gotcha. Christina, what is the latest, changing subjects a bit, just a little bit here, what's the latest on the request from the president's Election Integrity Commission for voter information from all the states, including, of course, Georgia?
Sure. That request is actually on hold.
Right.
They put out an email asking states to hold off on sending any information. And this, of course, is the information about voters that states keep on their rolls. It could be your name, address, things like that. They asked them to hold off because of one lawsuit, although I should add there are several lawsuits actually against this voter fraud panel. The one lawsuit they were asking folks to hold off on is seeking a temporary restraining order on the request anyway, and they're waiting for a federal court to rule on
mm-hmm.
that request, I think before they go forward possibly with collecting the information. I should add, in Georgia, the public voter file, these are public records accessible to anyone in the public who requests them, require a payment of a $250
yes.
fee, and that's standard for everyone. Georgia has asked that voter panel to pay that fee. The panel has not yet responded to that request. So there was a question of when Georgia would send that information anyway.
Right. Okay. So after President Trump created this commission, to collect voter data from states, a PBS NewsHour asked the chancellor's professor of law, and let me go slowly with this because there's a lot here, the chancellor's professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, his name is Rick Hassan, for his view on the request.
The president had said he wanted to look into the potential for voter fraud. There were a couple of Democrats on the commission who said that they wanted to look into Russian meddling. But mm-hmm. I'm concerned that it's going to be something that is just going to try to support the president's agenda, that claiming that there's a lot of voter fraud, and use that to make it harder for people to be able to register to vote.
So, Christina, what kind of information is available in this public file that you mentioned just a moment ago?
Well, it varies by state.
Okay.
And we should add that election systems in the United States, it's sort of a patchwork, which mm-hmm. can be a plus and a minus. But in this case, in Georgia, there's specific information available, such as your name, your address, what race or gender you may be. It may include your, when I say voting history, that does not include who you voted for, but that just says whether you participated in a certain election. In Georgia, you do not register by party, so that information would not be available, but the state does allow you to ask for a party-specific primary ballot. So if it's, say, the presidential primary, you ask to vote in the Republican primary, and so you can, you know, if you would have been able to pick between, say, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, that information of which ballot you picked would be available. But again, I stress the ballot is secret,
yep.
So they're not going to know who you voted for.
Is it safe to assume that clearing all of the roadblocks, that Georgia's Secretary of State will provide this information to the commission looking into this?
The Secretary of State's office has said yes. It views it as a public records request, and it's not in the habit, it says, of denying that request based on politics or anything else. Again, it requires a payment of that $250
right.
fee. Which we're waiting to see if the panel will do, but they have indicated they would share it. I do want to add, Georgia does have certain laws about privacy. So what will not be on that file would include your driver's license number, for example, or any part of your Social Security number that is private, and that would not be included.
Okay. And, you know, there are a lot of challenges to voter rolls across the country these days and seemingly over the last few years. If you're a voter in Georgia and you want to make sure that everything is buttoned up for you, we've got midterm elections coming up. What's the best way to go about doing that?
I think the Secretary of State's office certainly encourages people to go online. You can go to their website, sos.ga.gov, and there's something called the MVP site, and that is somewhere you can log in and correct any information about yourself and your specific voter registration. That can include address changes. That can include making sure your name is correct, anything like that. I think that's an option that most voters would be encouraged to do,
mm-hmm.
Just, again, to be sure everything is correct. You know, and if you do have questions, you can contact your local county elections office. That's another option.
Okay, and what's the latest on maybe the most serious challenge right now to the voter rolls in Georgia, if you can button that up for me?
There are a couple different things going on. So there are certainly voter advocacy groups looking at the idea of how Georgia kicks voters off the rolls.
Right.
There's one lawsuit that a federal judge ruled in favor of the state, the state's system of cleaning up its voter rolls. And I should add, it takes years for a voter to get kicked off the rolls.
Okay.
And there's something that developed over the last few days where the ACLU of Georgia is looking at how local counties may contact voters who move within a county. So if you live in Alpharetta and you move to Atlanta,
yeah.
you're still within Fulton County. But Fulton County recently sent out notices to those kinds of voters seeking some sort of confirmation. And I know there's a question by these groups, at least, of whether that's something that's legal.
Christina, appreciate it. Thank you for your time this morning.
Absolutely, Tony. Thank you for
having
me.
Yeah, pleasure. That's Christina Torres from the AJC. And just ahead, debating the death penalty, how capital punishment continues to divide the nation. But first, Vinyl Records making a comeback in Georgia. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Vinyl records are making a comeback. You could chalk it up to hipster millennials or the persistence of dedicated audiophiles. Whatever the reasons, more folks want analog music again. KinderCore Vinyl in Athens is the newest and only vinyl pressing plant in Georgia. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke last week with KinderCore president Ryan Lewis.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being with us. What does KinderCore mean?
Okay. Well, back in the 90s, around 96, we were in Athens in bands and started a record label, a friend of mine and I, and just to sort of put out our own record and document our friends that were doing stuff. And so we had to come up with a name for it, which in the beginning we weren't taking it very seriously. So we just sort of made up this joke name on just sort of how there were all these subgenres in music that all had core on the end, like, you know, hardcore, emo core, grindcore, whatever. And so we just came up with a silly one because everybody in town referred to us as kids because we were all like 20. So Kindercore was born then, and we ran it as a record label until the early 2000s. And then when we decided to do this, we figured we'd bring it back.
I wonder how closely that sort of parallels the rise of vinyl. I mean, I think that when vinyl started selling again, many people thought as sort of a niche market, and that's turning out to be wider spread than people expected. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, you can go into Cracker Barrel and buy vinyl now, amazingly. Apparently, they sell it in Whole Foods. I mean, you can get vinyl really places where you wouldn't have been able to get CDs before. It's sort of incredible how pervasive it's become. And even just noticing it in television, commercials, movies, even like sporting event openings. I think it was like the Super Bowl or something had like turntable visuals, which was sort of amazing to me. But yeah, it's definitely worked its way back into popular culture.
So from your I'm going to read a quote from you from your press release and get you to explain it for me. So this says, because of the explosion in vinyl sales, says Ryan Lewis, keeping up with demand without sacrificing quality has been an industry-wide struggle. What do you mean?
Actually, one of the interesting things that happened, I mean, like you were saying about our rise and fall as a label and then return as a vinyl plant sort of does follow the arc of the way the industry changed. But so in that sense, a lot of plants in the early 2000s started downsizing and some of them were closing. So once things turned around and demand for vinyl picked up again, I think a lot of plants were caught off guard by that and they had to spend a lot more energy putting people in production positions instead of quality control and customer service. So unfortunately, over the last decade, customer service and quality control have really gone downhill within the industry, I think, because people have just had a hard time scaling back up and keeping up with it. So that's something that we're really focused on addressing, putting out really high-quality records and having really responsive customer service.
So one of the things that you guys use is what's called a warm tone press.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean? And remember that there are people here that maybe who are hearing this who have maybe never used or even touched a vinyl record.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So the process of making records, the actual physical process of melting plastic pellets and squishing them into records, that part of it hasn't changed since the beginning of records. But the what has changed, though, is that for decades there have only been old machines available. So they stopped designing new machines in the late 70s, early 80s. And so all the plants that are out there either have those actual old machines, which is sort of like a Cuba situation where everybody's trying to keep old cars running and you're like buying old machines and taking parts and switching them out with each other. Or they have some newer machines that are basically just the old ones remachined and rebuilt. But the Warm Tone, the thing that we're so excited about is it's a new company in Canada called Viral Technology. And they have developed a new press from the ground up that's fully automated. It has digital sensors to make sure that all the temperature and humidity settings are correct. I mean, basically, it's supposed to make more consistent records faster. And we're really excited about that because it's taking an old end product, you know, an old analog end product, but creating it with the benefit of all the modern digital technology. So it's very exciting.
So to what do you attribute the rise in vinyl record sales? Is it just all those hipsters with the beards and the short hair?
Well, as a hipster with beard and sort of shortish hair, I mean, I wouldn't give myself and my peers all the credit for that. But I think really honestly what happened, at least the way that I saw it, because I've worked in record stores for years, is that when digital music became so prevalent and people were, you know, downloading things from iTunes or different stores or just pirating music. There was a while there where people, I feel like, weren't really able to give each other music. You couldn't really gift music as easily. You know, it's not very exciting to buy an iTunes gift card and give it to someone and say, hey, I really dig this record. You should go download it. Because for one, they're probably not going to do that. They're going to go download whatever they want. But it's just not that exciting. And the first time that it really hit me that it was coming back in such a big way was a few Christmases ago when I started to notice that people were buying tons of vinyl as presents. And I would be talking to older people who were like, oh, yeah, all my nieces and nephews just want vinyl for Christmas, blah, blah, blah. And so I think what it is sort of bringing us back to, you know, the importance of having something physical and something that, you know, feels like a very tangible artistic creation in your hands versus having something that you download. It's just more personal. And, you know, the size of the art and everything else, it's just, you know, there's something I think inherently that we got right as a music industry when vinyl was the dominant form, and nothing has really been able to permanently unseat it because it just sort of is that thing that we love. And, you know, the nice thing about it is that it works really well in conjunction with digital download technology. I mean, personally, I, you know, have a subscription to Apple Music and I paid $9 a month so that I know what record I want to spend $30 on. You know, I don't want to go out and spend $20, $30 on a record that I haven't heard. So I'll listen to it streaming, find what I like, go out and buy it. I think the two work really well together. So in that sense, I think it's exciting. It's not so much a rejection of the new as it is sort of a combination of the best of both things.
But it also changes the way you listen to music, right? I mean, I had I had Thriller on vinyl, and they yeah. had to construct those records so that when you – they had to think about what was the first song you hear when mm-hmm. you flipped the disc over, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Number one, I was more likely to listen to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. As opposed to shuffling all my selections, but they also had to sort of structure it so that there was an intermission break while you were flipping it over.
Absolutely.
What difference does that make?
Well, and actually it goes even further than that because there are physical, not so much limitations, but there's just, you know, there are physical demands and physical realities created by a piece of vinyl spinning that affect where you should put certain kinds of songs. So there are things like, you know, a noisier song should come first and a quieter song should be towards the middle of the record just because of the way that the physics of the whole operation move. And so that kind of stuff is really exciting as well. So you start to think, oh, well, maybe the reason why this album that I love ends with a really, you know, quiet, slow song on the end of side A is because that's what they were thinking about, you know. And also thinking about the time that records could last. In the 70s, when albums became so much of a bigger thing, you had bands trying to push how long an album could be and then eventually pushing more and more into double album sets because there are actually physical limitations about how long a record can be. So in that sense, you combine all those things together, and I think it just gives you a more deliberate album, something that people have spent more time thinking about the intricacies of how it's going to sound in context. And I mean, there's, you know, it's great to get in your car and listen to digital music. It's great to, you know, go for a run or walk the dog or do whatever. But really sitting down at home and putting an album on and listening to it from, you know, beginning to end, both sides, is just something you can't match with digital music. It's just dropping the needle and playing it through and then having to get up and switch it. It's just, you know, it's much more involved. It demands a little more from the listener, I think.
So, Ryan, the trends that we're seeing in terms of purchasing vinyl are often nationwide trends. Is there a market for vinyl in Georgia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in really, it's internationally, but yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at some of the great record stores in Georgia, the Wuxtries and Wax and Facts and places like that, all those places have gone back to stocking mostly vinyl. Most places are doing, you know, some used CDs, but maybe no new CDs. It's really the prevalent way that people are buying music right now.
That is Ryan Lewis. He's the president of Kindercore Vinyl in Athens. Ryan, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Atlanta cellist Nick Ogawa, popularly known as Takanobu, takes his cello away from the orchestra. His latest album, Reversal, uses loops and percussive sounds to create thick, intricate soundscapes. You might well think that would be great music for a movie, and you'd be dialed in. He also writes music for film and TV. We caught up with Takanobu last week.
Hey, I'm Takanobu, and I'm a cellist from Atlanta. I always wanted to be like, well, first I wanted to be like a rock star or something, but now I'm, you know, accepting that I'm doing something a little bit more tame than that. But people would always say that my music sounded like something from a movie, which I didn't really think very much of until people started to ask me if they could use my songs in their videos or that kind of thing. And then I was just like, well, I might as well just start writing for that purpose.
My time of need, I was lost in the abyss. But then you pulled me out and you built me up, but only for a time before it all gave up.
I find that the sense of space is very different in live performance versus film. Like in film, things can breathe a lot more. In a live performance, you don't want to lose the audience and have too much space. So it's kind of straddling those two different worlds. But it's a good way to think about music too, because it's, you know, you can get locked into just always being entertaining all the time and not giving people a chance to reflect. I grew up playing music my whole life. My parents had me studying Suzuki violin when I was 3. And then I studied classical music until I was about 18, and then just kind of got tired of the classical world and just wanted to branch out. And I mean, I love classical music, but I just didn't enjoy the orchestra structure and the audition processes and just the clamoring for chair position wasn't my personality. So I also just really like writing stuff, so to use the cello as a writing tool is kind of not classical, so I just branched away from it. First piece I discovered was this piece, Julio, by Mark Summer of the Turtle Island String Quartet. It just blew my mind because he was slapping the cello and doing all these kinds of, like, very guitar-y types of techniques that just sounded, you know, blew my mind when I heard it, because I was like, this is what I want a cello to sound like, or to, you know, at least be doing more far out things. And then I discovered looping, and I tried out a loop pedal at a guitar store and, you know, immediately bought it and kind of made that a primary part of my writing process. The cello is really conducive for that because it has so many different voices within it, because you can, you know, you can pizzicato backbone to things and then bowed harmony lines on top of it and then kind of weave stuff in and out of it and layer it, and that's what I do. Exposition is like a primo example of how I'm using the loop pedal, just to build up stuff and take it away and kind of make it a little crazy and then bring it back to earth again. Here I am with my cello that I had in my car. Thought I'd bring it in, play a tune. So this is Shady Grove, old Appalachian folk song that I learned. This is the first song I learned how to sing and play at the same time.
Peaches in the summertime, apples in the fall. If I can't have a girl I love, don't want none at all. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove.
That's Atlanta cello player and composer Takanobu. He performs at Eddie's Attic in Decatur tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. Just ahead, do Americans enjoy the spectacle of capital punishment? This is On Second Thought.
Golden twine, and every tune I played on it, I wish that girl was mine. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove. I wish I had a little.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Last semester, the University of Georgia suspended one of its fraternities because of misconduct during a hazing ceremony. The City Commission also has temporarily banned the construction of new bars downtown. So our question for you is this: does Athens have a partying problem? That conversation is tomorrow, but we'd love to get your opinion today. Give us a call at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk, and then join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. Court trials can determine life or death, and when they do, it's about more than just one person's fate. Our guest says sentencing and execution ceremonies are spectacles, and how we react to them reveals deeply held beliefs about the role of government in our lives. Professor Daniel LaChance is here. He is a history professor at Emory. His new book is titled Executing Freedom, The Cultural Life of Capital Punishment in the United States. The book documents the changing perception of the death penalty in America over the last half century. Daniel, good to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
That is such a provocative statement. Execution ceremonies, first of all, the idea of a ceremony, right?
Right.
Are spectacles. Spectacles that say what about us?
Well, you know, the way in which, you know, when we think about an execution, it's sort of the moment of the greatest portrayal of the relationship between a government and its citizens, right?
Yeah.
The very notion of sovereignty is the power over life and death, and this is a moment where the government makes that ultimate decision to take someone out of this world.
Yeah.
And so historically, these were very big public events up until the 1930s. Thousands of people would come and watch them. They were places where a community would reaffirm its commitment to morality, to its deeply held beliefs about what brings us together as a people. And, you know, since then, they've become these sort of secluded private affairs that are carried out in prisons in the middle of states far from where the crime occurred. And they're quite different these days, but we still kind of imagine them as spectacles.
Why did they change? Why did they change from being public spectacles to more closed off events?
Right. Well, there was a real sense that these public spectacles were actually creating more lawlessness than they were deterring or preventing. And so elites in the 19th century, you know, starting in the Northeast and then moving their way south and southwest, began to sort of try to rein in the excesses that they saw happening at the site of an execution. They had hoped that these events would be moments for people to kind of learn lessons and sort of reaffirm their allegiance to the kind of social contract. But what they were finding is that oftentimes that wasn't the case, and they were worried about the way that these executions were perhaps feeding more sadistic desires to sort of see violence and death rather than trying to put people back on or maintain them on the path towards righteousness.
There's an interesting statement in that, isn't there?
Right.
So let's do a little bit of the history work here. In a 1972 ruling involving a Georgia case, the U.S. Supreme Court said the death penalty was cruel and unusual punishment and violated the Constitution. That ruling resulted in the death penalty being struck down nationwide. And Daniel, but here's the thing. 4 years later, in yet another Georgia case, the high court reversed the earlier ruling and declared the death penalty constitutional. Justice Potter, Stewart here, delivered the opinion.
Mm-hmm. Left unguided, juries imposed the death sentence in a way that could only be called freakish. The new Georgia sentencing procedures, by contrast, focus the jury's attention on the particularized nature of the crime and the particularized characteristics of the individual defendant.
So, Daniel, what changed mm-hmm. in the country and with the high court in those 4 years?
Well, there's two kinds of changes happening. There's a real big sea change that happens in public opinion. You know, in the late 1950s, support for the death penalty was down. It was hovering around 50%, which is the lowest it had ever been since the 1930s when Gallup started measuring people's opinion about it. But the 1960s saw a kind of tripling of violent crime across the United States. It also saw all
the
sorts
turbulent
of,
60s.
Turbulent 60s. It also saw all sorts of social revolutions. There was anxiety about cities going up in flames every summer. Richard Nixon comes into power, you know, talking about the first civil right is actually the right to be safe in your own homes, appealing to a silent majority. And so the death penalty goes from being this kind of thing that everyone thinks we're on the road to abandoning to right at the moment when the Supreme Court is abolishing it, a kind of sea change in public opinion is taking place. And more Americans are saying that they want the death penalty, that the death penalty delivers a kind of moral clarity. It delivers a kind of justice that they so often found lacking in the government that they faced, that they found themselves facing.
In what years did we see the high point of support for capital punishment? Mm-hmm.
So support begins rising in the late 60s, and then it tops out in the middle of the 1990s at about 80%.
80%?
80% of Americans in the middle of the 1990s told Gallup that they support the death penalty.
So have a listen to Kent Scheidegger. He is the legal director of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, which supports capital punishment.
An executed killer never kills again. We cannot say that for certain with a killer sentenced to life without parole. Life without parole is not a zero-risk option. If we choose life in prison for killers, we do risk killing innocent people.
Does he sort of capture in that statement the sentiment of the times we're talking about the 90s?
There's a lot of, you know, violent crime starts declining in the early 1990s,
yeah.
But incarceration rates continue to rise.
Explode.
Execution rates continue to rise. So there's a little bit of a mismatch between the kind of threat Americans were facing and the response to that threat. But he captures this kind of sense that, you know, maybe the death penalty isn't a deterrent. But one thing that we can know for sure that it does do is it delivers justice to victims' family members, and it also kind of makes sure no one will ever kill again. And that really comes out of this sense that, you know, the kind of rehabilitation-oriented approach of the 1960s and the 1970s was a kind of coddling of criminals.
I remember those days when we talked about rehabilitation. We don't talk about rehabilitation anymore.
We don't. And one, part of the reasons that we don't talk about it is not only did conservatives who thought that it was kind of coddling criminals, it was part of a larger welfare state that created dependency, that eschewed personal responsibility. That's a big part of it. But it was also the left. The left was also very suspicious of rehabilitation. They saw kind of people being detained under indeterminate sentences in prisons until they were deemed rehabilitated by the state. And so there's this kind of bipartisan rebellion against rehabilitation, which creates the vacuum into which retribution kind of comes back.
Daniel, to what extent are we as a nation even grappling with the real risk associated with the death penalty? And we're talking about the risk that you might put an innocent person to death.
Right. Well, I think that's a big part of why support for the death penalty has declined over the last 15 years. So we sort of top out in the 90s, but if you look at the opinion polls, we're back down to where we were in the early 1960s. We're sort of back into the 50-60% support range. And a big part of that, some have argued, is the DNA revolution and the way in which DNA became this kind of way to exonerate people who had been wrongly convicted of murder, both those on death row and those who were not on death row. The kind of discussion about the death penalty shifts from the 1990s to the 2000s. It goes from, is this morally right or wrong? Do people deserve to live when they take other lives? To are we making sure that innocent people aren't going to be wrongly put to death? And that's part of the story of why kind of Americans have taken a second look at the death penalty, and many of them have kind of started to doubt it.
And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Emory history professor Daniel Lachance, whose new book follows the evolution of America's perception of the death penalty. To that point, here's Kent Scheidegger again.
But ask yourself, where would those people be if they had been sentenced to life without parole instead? In most cases, they would still be in prison, and they would never get out, because an inmate who is sentenced to death gets a government-paid lawyer for the second review of his case and the third review of his case, and that is where this evidence often comes out.
So, Daniel, how many states is it? 17 still have the death penalty on the books?
Yeah, it's about that. You know, some states have it on the books and they don't really ever execute anyone. They have big death rows like California. Others like Georgia and Texas have it on the books, and you see executions almost every year.
And here's the question I'm driving at here: have the states with the death penalty still on the books concluded that the risk of executing an innocent person is an acceptable risk?
Sometimes you see that kind of rhetoric. You know, folks who have testified in front of Congress, economists who believe there's a deterrent effect, say, you know, net you're saving more people than you're putting people to death. Every public policy has collateral damage. We shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. If someone who's innocent is sometimes executed, that pales in comparison to the benefits that the death penalty provide. But I don't know that really has a lot of traction with folks. Folks really do sort of have this sense that it is deeply wrong to put to death an innocent person, and that nobody should be the collateral damage of a public policy in such a draconian way.
So you haven't witnessed an execution, but you have read accounts of executions.
Yes.
What do you take away from those accounts?
Well, what's interesting is that there's this kind of gap between the way folks imagine the death penalty as this kind of, you know, it used to be this very religious public ceremony, but as a sort of an act that brings closure to victims' family members, an act that kind of expresses our moral commitments, a kind of ritualistic ceremony, and the actual life of the death penalty. So as a result of all those changes from the courts in the 1970s, appeals times have grown incredibly long. So a few years ago, the average time for those executed between sentencing and execution reached 16 and a half years. In California, it's 25. California has over 700 people on death row. It's executed in the last 40 years less than a dozen. And so the kind of world that a lot of folks imagine the death penalty bringing about, a world in which people get closure, in which there's a kind of finality that the state is expressing a moral clarity. It rarely happens. And then the actual ceremony itself, and this is the other thing that's really new about the death penalty since the 1970s and unprecedented in our history, is lethal injection. The way or the manner in which people are put to death resembles a kind of surgical procedure. It resembles an operation. So when you hear about accounts of the death penalty, journalists often struggle to sort of express what's going on as a kind of punishment, because it looks like someone is just being put to sleep. And so that kind of notion that it delivers justice, that it's this ritual, that it's even punishment, right? It's harder and harder to see that when it takes forever to execute people and most people don't get executed. And then the actual ceremony itself resembles a medical procedure.
So let me play a couple of clips here from a film called The Sandman. It tells the story of a doctor who performs executions in Georgia. The doctor's name is Carlo Musso, and he doesn't exactly love the work that he does. Here he is talking about why he keeps doing it.
Quite frankly, I'd love to hang up my cleats and not do this anymore. As long as they're going to continue to perform executions in Georgia, then I think those individuals on death row deserve to have a physician present at the time of their death.
And right on the heels of that, here is Dr. Musso again comparing his work to that of a priest.
I don't think people who believe that physicians shouldn't be involved in execution would say the same for a priest. Being at the bedside at the time of an individual's death, particularly if he wanted that.
So, Daniel, why did you write this book?
It's a really good question. You know, I grew up the son of a criminal defense attorney. I grew up in Massachusetts, a state without the death penalty. But many of the guys that my dad defended over the years were really reviled, people that had been charged with raping children, people that had been charged with gruesome acts of murder. And many of them were, quite frankly, factually guilty and legally guilty, too. And so I was always sort of interested in the spectacle that his trials would sometimes produce, the way that it would bring out sort of deeply felt emotions about justice, about morality, and the ways in which we as a people respond to evil and horrible acts. And the death penalty is certainly been a site where that happens kind of potentially, perhaps most potently, that there's something about that this sort of way in which we go about punishing people that says something not just about justice, but about who we are as a people.
Daniel, thank you. Daniel Achance, professor of history at Emory University. His new book is Executing Freedom, The Cultural Life of Capital Punishment in the United States. A pleasure. Daniel,
thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Late last month, the city of Atlanta backed off a controversial ordinance requiring street artists to register their work. Some local artists filed a lawsuit charging the ordinance was doubly undesirable. It violated freedom of speech and meant less work. We talked about this in June with local artist Fabian Williams.
It goes against freedom of expression. Like, if I want to talk about things that are happening in the administration or in city government, I don't feel comfortable going to the city government asking permission to talk trash about the city government, if I'm going to do that. Or
right.
Even, you know, like having an opinionated piece or really anything. If I'm not receiving funds from the city and if they're not helping me get paid faster, what's the point?
We also talked to Monica Campana, executive director of Living Walls. That's a nonprofit which promotes better relationships between government and public artists.
I do think that the concern here is not so much, you know, what is the regulation that the city should have, but how do we support our artists enough, whether it is financially or by giving them access to resources for them to be able to learn better ways and processes to engage community when they are producing their work.
Greg Mike is president of the Outer Space Project, which brought dozens of muralists to Atlanta last month. He explained why public art is so important to the community.
You know, I see it every weekend with people that are coming in our neighborhood that, you know, just coming out to take pictures and explore and maybe venture out to areas that they've never been before. You know, I think it's a great way to change neighborhoods and make them better and get people out in the city and, you know, to explore their outer spaces.
Public artists may be free to work again, but Fabian Williams feels like they still have a long way to go in Atlanta.
We think it's a good time to now form a panel of artists as well as the community leaders to solve solutions like this. We should definitely be in the room coming up with creative solutions, like Greg was saying, to, you know, solve these issues.
To hear our full conversation about public art, go to gbbnews.org and click on the On Second Thought tab. And that's our show for today, but we always welcome your comments. Is street art valuable for your community or something you'd prefer to paint over? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also post on to Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.